had been recognised by a middle-aged man called Dreltram, also making his way to Trons. Mr. Dreltram would treasure a defeat at the hands of the great Jernan Gurge more than any victory over anybody else, would he play? Gurge was well used to such flattery. It usually masked an unrealistic but slightly feral ambition, but had suggested they play possession. It shared enough rule concepts with Stricken to make it a decent limbering-up exercise. They'd found a possession set in one of the bars and taken it out onto the roof deck, sitting behind a windbreak so that the cards wouldn't blow away. They ought to have enough time to complete the game. The train would take most of the day to get to Trons, a journey an underground car could accomplish in 10 minutes. The train left the bridge and entered a deep, narrow ravine, its slipstream producing an eerie, echoing noise off the naked rocks on either side. Gurge looked at the game board. He was playing straight, without the help of any glanded substances. His opponent was using a potent mixture suggested by Gurge himself. In addition, Gurge had given Mr. Dreltram a 7-piece lead at the start, which was the maximum allowed. The fellow wasn't a bad player, and had come near to overwhelming Gurge at the start, when his advantage in pieces had the greatest effect. But Gurge had defended well, and the man's chance had probably gone, though there was still the possibility he might have a few mines left in awkward places. Thinking of such unpleasant surprises, Gurge realized he hadn't looked where his own hidden piece was. This had been another unofficial way of making the game more even. Possession is played on a 40-square grid. The two players' pieces are distributed in one major group and two minor groups each. Up to 3 pieces can be hidden on different initially unoccupied intersections. Their locations are dialed, and locked, into 3 circular cards, thin ceramic wafers which are turned over only when the player wishes to bring those pieces into play. Mr. Dreltram had already revealed all 3 of his hidden pieces. One had happened to be on the intersection Gurge had sportingly sewn all 9 of his mines on, which really was bad luck. Gurge had spun the dials on his single hidden piece wafer and put it face down on the table without looking at it. He had no more idea where that piece was than Mr. Dreltram. It might turn out to be in an illegal position, which could well lose him the game, or, less likely, it might turn up in a strategically useful place deep inside his opponent's territory. Gurge liked playing this way. It wasn't a serious game. As well as giving his opponent a probably needed extra advantage, it made the match as a whole more interesting and less predictable, added an extra spice to the proceedings. He supposed he ought to find out where the piece was. The 80 move point was fast approaching when the piece had to be revealed anyway. He couldn't see his hidden piece wafer. He looked over the card and wafer-strewn table. Mr. Dreltram was not the most tidy of players. His cards and wafers and unused or removed pieces were scattered over most of the table, including the part supposed to be Gurge's. A gust of wind, when they'd entered a tunnel an hour earlier, had almost blown some of the lighter cards away, and they'd weighed them down with goblets and lead glass paperweights. These added to the impression of confusion, as did Mr. Dreltram's quaint, if rather affected, custom of noting down all the moves by hand on a scratch tablet. He claimed the built-in memory on a board had broken down on him once and lost him all record of one of the best games he'd ever played. Gurge started lifting bits and pieces up, humming to himself and looking for the flat wafer. He heard a sudden intake of breath, but then what sounded like a rather embarrassed cough just behind him. He turned round to see Mr. Dreltram behind him, looking oddly awkward. Gurge frowned as Mr. Dreltram, just returned from the bathroom, his eyes wide with the mixture of drugs he was glanding, and followed by a tray bearing drinks, sat down again, staring at Gurge's hands. It was only then, as the tray set the glasses on the table, that Gurge realized the cards he happened to be holding, which he had lifted up to look for his hidden piece wafer, were Mr. Dreltram's remaining mine cards. Gurge looked at them. They were still face down. He hadn't seen where the mines were, and understood what Mr. Dreltram must be thinking. He put the cards back where he'd found them. "I'm very sorry," he laughed. "I was looking for my hidden piece." He saw it, even as he spoke the words. The circular wafer was lying, uncovered, almost right in front of him on the table. "Ah," he said, and only then felt the blood rise to his face. "Here it is. Couldn't see it for looking at it." He laughed again, and as he did so, felt a strange clutching sensation coursing through him, seeming to squeeze his guts in something between terror and ecstasy. He had never experienced anything like it. The closest any sensation had ever come, he thought, suddenly clearly, had been when he was still a boy, and he'd experienced his first orgasm at the hands of a girl a few years older than him. Crude, purely human basic, like a single instrument picking out a simple theme a note at a time, compared to the drug-gland-boosted symphonies sex would later become. That first time had nevertheless been one of his most memorable experiences, not just because it was then novel, but because it seemed to open up a whole new fascinating world, an entirely different type of sensation and being. It had been the same when he'd played his first competition game as a child, representing Chark against another Orbital's junior team, and it would be the same again when his drug glands matured a few years after puberty. Mr. Dreltrum laughed too, and wiped his face with a handkerchief. Gürge played furiously for the next few moves, and had to be reminded by his opponent when the 80-move deadline came up. Gürge turned over his hidden piece without having checked it first, risking it occupying the same square as one of his revealed pieces. The hidden piece, on a 1600-to-1 chance, turned up in the same position as the heart, the piece the whole game was about, the piece one's opponent was trying to take possession of. Gürge stared at the intersection where his well-defended heart piece sat, then again at the coordinates he'd dialed at random onto the wafer 2 hours earlier. They were the same, there was no doubt. If he'd looked a move earlier, he could have moved the heart out of danger, but he hadn't. He'd lost both pieces, and with the heart lost, the game was lost. He'd lost.
"Oh, bad luck,"
Mr. Dreltram said, clearing his throat. Gürge nodded. "I believe it's customary at such moments of disaster for the defeated player to be given the heart as a keepsake," he said, fingering the lost piece.
So I understand," Mr. Dreltram said,
obviously at once embarrassed on Gürge's behalf and delighted at his good fortune. Gürge nodded. He put the heart down, lifted the ceramic wafer which had betrayed him.
"I'd rather have this, I think."
He held it up to Mr. Dreltram, who nodded.
"Well, of course. I mean, why not? I certainly wouldn't object."
The train rolled quietly into a tunnel, slowing for a station set in the caverns inside the mountain. All reality is a game. Physics at its most fundamental, the very fabric of our universe, results directly from the interaction of certain fairly simple rules and chance. The same description may be applied to the best, most elegant, and most intellectually and aesthetically satisfying games. By being unknowable, by resulting from events which at the subatomic level cannot be fully predicted, the future remains malleable, and retains the possibility of change, the hope of coming to prevail. Victory, to use an unfashionable word. In this, the future is the game. Time is one of the rules. Generally, all the best mechanistic games, those which can be played in any sense perfectly, such as Grid, Prallian Scope, and Cradle, Chess, Farnic Dimensions, can be traced to civilizations lacking a relativistic view of the universe, let alone the reality. They are also, I might add, invariably pre-machine sentient societies. The very first rank games acknowledge the element of chance, even if they rightly restrict raw luck. To attempt to construct a game on any other lines, no matter how complicated and subtle the rules are, and regardless of the scale and differentiation of the playing volume and the variety of the powers and attributes of the pieces, is inevitably to shackle oneself to a conspectus which is not merely socially, but techno-philosophically lagging several ages behind our own. As a historical excuse, it might have some value. As a work of the intellect, it's just a waste of time. If you want to make something old-fashioned, why not build a wooden sailing boat or a steam engine? They're just as complicated and demanding as a mechanistic game, and you'll keep fit at the same time. Gürge gave an ironic bow to the young man who'd approached him with an idea for a game. The fellow looked nonplussed. He took a breath and opened his mouth to speak. Gürge was waiting for this, as he had on the last 5 or 6 occasions when the young man had tried to say something. Gürge interrupted him before he'd even started. "I'm quite serious, you know. There's nothing intellectually inferior about using your hands to build something, as opposed to using only your brain. The same lessons can be learned, the same skills acquired, at the only levels that really matter." He paused again. He could see the drone, Morin Skell, floating toward him over the heads of the people thronging the broad plaza. The main concert was over. The mountain summits around Trons echoed to the sounds of various smaller bands as people gravitated toward the specific musical forms they preferred. Some formal, some improvised, some for dancing, some for experiencing under a specific drug trance. It was a warm, cloudy night. A little far-side light shone a milky halo directly overhead on the high overcast. Trons, the largest town on both the plate and the orbital, had been built on the edge of the Gavant Plate's great central massif, at the point where the kilometre-high Lake Trons flowed over the lip of the plateau and tumbled its waters toward the plain below, where they fell as a permanent downpour into the rainforest. Trons was the home of fewer than 100,000 people, but to Gergé it still felt too crowded, despite its spacious houses and squares, its sweeping galleries and plazas and terraces, its thousands of houseboats and its elegant bridge-linked towers. Trons, for all the fact that Chark was a fairly recent orbital, only 1,000 or so years old, was already almost as big as any orbital community ever grew. The culture's real cities were its great ships, the general systems vehicles. Orbitals were its rustic hinterland, where people liked to spread themselves out with plenty of elbow room. In terms of scale, when compared to one of the larger GSVs containing billions of people, Trons was barely a village. Gergé usually attended the Trons' 64th day concert, and he was usually buttonholed by enthusiasts. Normally, Gergé was civil, if occasionally abrupt. Tonight, after the fiasco on the train and that strange, exciting, shaming pulse of emotion he'd experienced as a result of being thought to cheat, not to mention the slight nervousness he'd felt because he'd heard the girl off the GSV cargo cult was indeed here in Trons this evening and looking forward to meeting him, he was in no mood to suffer fools gladly. Not that the unlucky young male was necessarily a complete idiot. All he'd done was sketch out what had been, after all, not a bad idea for a game. But Gergé had fallen on him like an avalanche. The conversation, if you could call it that, had become a game. The object was to keep talking. Not to talk continuously, which any idiot could do, but to pause only when the young man was not signalling, through bodily or facial language or actually starting to speak, that he wanted to cut in. Instead, Gergé would stop unexpectedly in the middle of a point, or after having just said something mildly insulting, but while still giving the impression he was going to keep talking. Also, Gergé was quoting almost verbatim from one of his own more famous papers on game theory. An added insult, as the young man probably knew the text as well as he did. To imply, Gergé continued, as the young man's mouth started to open again, that one can remove the element of luck, chance, happenstance in life by...
"Sure now, Gergé, not interrupting anything, am I?"
Morin Skell said.
"Nothing of note," Gergé said, turning to face the small machine.
"How are you, Morin Skell? Been up to any fresh mischief?"
"Nothing of note,"
the tiny drone echoed, as the young man Gergé had been talking to sidled off. Gergé sat in a creeper-covered pergola, positioned close to one edge of the plaza, near the observation platforms which reached out over the broad curtain of the falls, where spray rose from the rapids lying between the lip of the lake and the vertical drop to the forest a kilometre below. The roaring falls provided a background wash of white noise.
"I found your young adversary," the small drone announced.
It extended one slowly glowing blue field and plucked a night flower from a growing vine.
"Hmm?" Gergé said. "Oh, the young, stricken player."
"That's right," Morin Skell said evenly. "The young, stricken player."
It folded some of the nightflower's petals back, straining them on the plucked stem.
"I heard she was here," Gergé said.
"She's at Halfless's table. Shall we go and meet her?"
"Why not?" Gergé stood. The machine floated away.
"Nervous?"
Morin Skell asked, as they headed through the crowds toward one of the raised terraces level with the lake, where Halfless's apartments were.
"Nervous," Gergé said, "of a child."
Morin Skell floated silently for a moment or two, as Gergé climbed some steps. Gergé nodded and said hello to a few people, then the machine came close to him and said quietly, as it slowly stripped the petals from the dying blossom,
"Want me to tell you your heart rate, skin receptivity level, pheromone signature, neuron function state?"
Its voice trailed off as Gergé came to a halt, halfway up the flight of broad steps. He turned to face the drone, looking through half-hooded eyes at the tiny machine. Music drifted over the lake and the air was full of the nightflower's musky scent. The lighting set into the stone balustrades lit the game player's face from underneath. People flooding down the steps from the terrace above, laughing and joking, parted round the man like waters round a rock, and, Morin Skell noticed, went oddly quiet as they did so. After a few seconds, as Gergé stood there silent, breathing evenly, the little drone made a chuckling noise.
"Not bad," it said. Not bad at all. I can't tell just yet what you're landing, but that's a very impressive degree of control. Everything parameter-centered, near as damn. Except your neuron function state. That's even less like normal than usual. But then your average civilian drone probably couldn't spot that. Well done.
Don't let me detain you, Morinskell, Gergay said coldly. I'm sure you can find something else to amuse you besides watching me play a game.
He continued up the broad steps.
Nothing currently on this orbital is capable of detaining me, dear Mr. Gergay, the drone said matter-of-factly,
tearing the last of the petals from the nightflower. It dropped the husk in the water channel, which ran along the top of the balustrade.
Gergay, good to see you. Come, sit down.
Estray Haflis's party of 30 or so people sat around a huge rectangular stone table set on a balcony jutting out over the falls and covered by stone arches strung with nightflower vines and softly shining paper lanterns. There were music players at one end, sitting on the edge of the great slab with drums and strings and air instruments. They were laughing and playing, mostly for themselves, each trying to play too fast for the others to follow. Set into the centre of the table was a long narrow pit full of glowing coals. A kind of miniaturized bucket line trundled above the fire, carrying little meat and vegetable pieces from one end of the table to the other. They were skewered onto the line at one end by one of Haflis's children, and removed at the other end, wrapped in edible paper, and thrown with a fair degree of accuracy to anybody who wanted them, by Haflis's youngest, who was only 6. Haflis was unusual in having had 7 children. Normally people bore one and fathered one. The culture frowned on such profligacy, but Haflis just liked being pregnant. He was in a male stage at the moment, however, having changed a few years earlier. He and Gergay exchanged pleasantries, then Haflis showed the game player to a seat beside Professor Boruelal, who was grinning happily and swaying in her seat. She wore a long black and white robe, and when she saw Gergay, kissed him noisily on the lips. She attempted to kiss Morinskell too, but it flicked away. She laughed and speared a half-done piece of meat from the line over the centre of the table with a long fork.
Gergay, meet the lovely Orts Hap, Orts Jerna Gergay. Come on, shake hands.
Gergay sat down, taking the small, pale hand of the frightened-looking girl on Boruelal's right. She was wearing something dark and shapeless, and was in her early teens at most. He smiled with a slight frown, glancing at the professor, trying to share the joke of her inebria with the young blonde girl, but Old Sap was looking at his hand, not his face. She let her hand be touched, but then withdrew it almost immediately. She sat on her hands and stared at her plate. Baruelal breathed deeply, seeming to gather herself together. She took a drink from a tall glass in front of her.
"Well," she said, looking at Gergay, as though he'd only just appeared, "how are you, Jelna?"
"Well enough." He watched Morinskell manoeuvre itself beside Alt's Hap, floating over the table beside her plate, fields all formal blue and green friendliness.
"Good evening,"
he heard the drone say in its most avuncular voice. The girl brought her head up to look at the machine, and Gergay listened to their conversation at the same time as he and Boruelal talked.
"Hello."
"Well enough to play a game of Stricken?" "Morinskell's the name, Alt's Hap, am I right?"
"I think so, Professor. Are you well enough to invigilate?"
"Yes. How do you do?"
"Fuck me, no. Drunk as a desert spring. Have to get somebody else. I suppose I could calm down in time, but... nah.
Oh, shake fields with me, eh? That's very sweet of you, so few people bother. How nice to meet you. We've all heard so much."
"How about the young lady herself?"
Oh, dear. What?"
"What's wrong? Have I said something wrong?"
"Is she ready to play?"
"No, it's just, play what?"
"Ah, you're shy. You needn't be. Nobody'll force you to play, least of all Gergay, believe me."
"The game, Boruelal."
"Well, I... what do you mean now?"
"I wouldn't worry if I were you, really."
"Now or any time?"
"Well, I don't know. Let's ask her. Hey, kid."
"But..." Gergay began, but the professor had already turned to the girl.
"Alts, want to play this game, then?"
The young girl looked straight at Gergay. Her eyes were bright in the glare of the line of fire running down the centre of the table.
"If Mr. Gurgay would like to? Yes?
Morinskell's fields glowed red with pleasure, momentarily brighter than the coals.
Oh, good, it said. A fight!
Haflis had loaned his own ancient stricken set out. It took a few minutes for a supply drone to bring one from the town store. They set it up at one end of the balcony, by the edge overlooking the roaring white falls. Professor Baruelal fumbled with her terminal and put in a request for some adjudicating drones to oversee the game. Stricken was susceptible to high-tech cheating, and a serious game required that steps be taken to ensure nothing underhand went on. A drone visiting from Chark Hub volunteered, as did a manufacturing drone from the shipyard under the Massif. One of the university's own machines would represent Alt's Hap. Gurge turned to Morinskell to ask it to be his representative, but it said,
"Journal, Gurge, I thought you might like Chamlis Amaltnay to represent you."
"Is Chamlis here?"
"Right, a while ago. Been avoiding me. I'll ask it."
Gurge's button terminal beeped.
"Yes," he said.
Chamlis's voice spoke from the button.
"The fly dropping just asked me to represent you in a Stricken adjudication. Do you want me to?"
"Yes, I'd like you to," Gurge said, watching Morinskell's fields flicker white with anger in front of him.
"I'll be there in 20 seconds, Chamlis said, closing the channel.
21.2,
Morinskell said acidly, exactly 21.2 seconds later, as Chamlis appeared over the edge of the balcony, its casing dark against the cataract beyond. Chamlis turned its sensing band to the smaller machine.
"Thank you," Chamlis said warmly. "I had a bet on with myself that I'd have you counting the seconds to my arrival."
Morinskell's fields blazed brightly, painfully white, lighting up the entire balcony for a second. People stopped talking and turned. The music hesitated. The tiny drone seemed almost literally to shake with dumb rage.
"Fuck you!"
it screeched at last, and seemed to disappear, leaving only an afterimage of sun-bright blindness behind it in the night. The coals blazed bright. A wind whipped at clothes and hair. Several of the paper lanterns bucked and shook and fell from the arches overhead. Leaves and nightflowers drifted down from the two arches immediately over where Morinskell had been floating. Chamlis Amaltnay, red with happiness, tipped to look up into the dark sky, where a small hole appeared briefly in the cloud cover.
"Oh dear," it said. "Do you think I said something to upset it?"
Gurge smiled and sat down at the game set.
"Did you plan that, Chamlis?"
Amaltnay bowed in midair to the other drones and to Boruelal.
"Not exactly."
It turned to face Alt's Hap, sitting on the far side of the game web from Gurge.
"Ah, by way of contrast, a fair human."
The girl blushed, looked down. Boruelal made the introductions. Stricken is played in a three-dimensional web, stretched inside a meter cube. The traditional materials are taken from a certain animal on the planet of origin. Cured tendon for the web, tusk ivory for the frame. The set Gurge and Alt's Hap used was synthetic. They each put up their hinged screens, took the bags of hollow globes and coloured beads, nutshells and stones in the original, and selected the beads they wanted, locking them in the globes. The adjudicating drones ensured there was no possibility of anyone seeing which beads went into which shells. Then the man and the girl each took a handful of the little spheres and placed them in various places inside the web. The game had begun. She was good. Gurge was impressed. Alt's Hap was impetuous but canny, brave but not stupid. She was also very lucky. But there was luck and luck. Sometimes you could sniff it out, recognize things were going well and would probably continue to go well and play to that. If things did keep going right, you profited extravagantly. If the luck didn't persist, well, you just played the percentages. The girl had that sort of luck that night. She made the right guesses about Gurge's pieces, capturing several strong beads in weak disguises. She anticipated moves he'd sealed in the foretell shells, and she ignored the tempting traps and feints he set up. Somehow, he struggled on, coming up with desperate, improvised defenses against each attack. But it was all too seat-of-the-pants, too extemporary and tactical. He wasn't being allowed the time to develop his pieces or plan a strategy. He was responding, following, replying. He preferred to have the initiative. It was some time before he realized just how audacious the girl was being.
She was going for a full web. The simultaneous capture of every remaining point in the game space. She wasn't just trying to win. She was trying to pull off a coup which only a handful of the game's greatest players had ever accomplished, and which nobody in the culture, to Gurge's knowledge, had yet achieved. Gurge could hardly believe it, but it was what she was doing. She was sapping pieces, but not obliterating them, then falling back. She was striking out through his own avenues of weakness, then holding there. She was inviting him to come back, of course, giving him a better chance of winning, and indeed of achieving the same momentous result, though with far less hope of doing so. But the self-confidence of it! The experience of even arrogance such a course implied! He looked at the slight, calm-faced girl through the web of thin wires and little suspended spheres, and could not help but admire her ambition, her vaulting ability and self-belief. She was playing for the grand gesture and to the gallery, not settling for a reasonable win, despite the fact that the reasonable win would be over a famous, respected game player. And Borrowell had thought she might feel intimidated by him? Well, good for her. Gurge sat forward, rubbing his beard, oblivious of the people now packing the balcony, silently watching the game. He struggled back into it somehow, partly luck, partly more skill than even he thought he possessed. The game was still poised for a full web victory, and she was still the most likely to achieve it, but at least his position looked less hopeless. Somebody brought him a glass of water and something to eat. He vaguely recalled being grateful. The game went on. People came and went around him. The web held all his fortune. The little spheres, holding their secret treasures and threats, became like discrete parcels of life and death. Single points of probability which could be guessed at but never known until they were challenged, opened, looked at. All reality seemed to hinge on those infinitesimal bundles of meaning. He no longer knew what body-made drugs washed through him, nor could he guess what the girl was using. He had lost all sense of self and time. The game drifted for a few moves, as they both lost concentration, then came alive again. He became aware, very slowly, very gradually, that he held some impossibly complex model of the contest in his head, unknowably dense, multifariously planed. He looked at that model, twisted it. The game changed. He saw a way to win. The full web remained a possibility. His, now. It all depended. Another twist? Yes, he would win, almost certainly. But that was no longer enough. The full web beckoned, tantalizingly, seductively, entrancingly.
Gurge?
Baruelal shook him. He looked up. There was a hint of dawn over the mountains. Baruelal's face looked grey and sober.
Gurge, a break. It's been 6 hours. Do you agree? A break, yes?
He looked through the web at the pale, waxen face of the young girl. He gazed round in a sort of daze. Most of the people had gone. The paper lanterns had disappeared too. He felt vaguely sorry to have missed the little ritual of throwing the glowing lamps over the terrace edge and watching them drift down to the forest. Baruelal shook him once more.
Gurge.
Yes, a break. Yes, of course, he croaked. He got up, stiff and sore, muscles protesting and joints creaking. Chamlis had to stay with the game set to ensure the adjudication. Grey dawn spread across the sky. Somebody gave him some hot soup, which he sipped while he ate a few crackers and wandered through the quiet arcades for a while, where a few people slept or still sat and talked, or danced to quiet recorded music. He leaned on the balustrade above the kilometre drop, sipping and munching, dazed and vacant from the game, still playing and replaying it somewhere inside his head. The lights of the towns and villages on the mist-strewn plain below, beyond the semicircle of dark rainforest, looked pale and uncertain. Distant mountain tops shone pink and naked.
Gerno Gurge, a soft voice said.
He looked over the plain. The drone, Morin Skell, floated a meter from his face.
Morin Skell, he said quietly. Good morning.
Good morning.
How goes the game?
Fine, thank you.
I think I'll win now.
Pretty sure, in fact.
But there's just a chance I might win.
He felt himself smiling.
Famously,
Really?
Morin Skell continued to float there over the drop in front of him. It kept its voice soft, though there was nobody nearby. Its fields were off. Its surface was an odd, mottled mixture of grey tones.
Yes, Gergay said, and briefly explained about a full-web victory.
The drone seemed to understand.
So you have won, but you could win the full web, which no one in the culture has ever done save for exhibition purposes to prove its possibility.
That's right. He nodded, looked over the light-speckled plain.
That's right.
He finished the crackers, brushed his hands slowly free of crumbs. He left the soup bowl balanced on the balustrade.
Does it really, Morin Skell said thoughtfully, matter who first wins a full web?
Hmm? Gergay said. Morin Skell drifted closer.
Does it really matter who first wins one? Somebody will. But does it count for much who does? It would appear to be a very unlikely eventuality in any given game. Has it really much to do with skill?
Not beyond a certain point, Gergay admitted. It requires a lucky genius.
But that could be you.
Maybe.
Gergay smiled across the gulf of chill morning air. He drew his jacket closer about him.
It depends entirely on the disposition of certain coloured beads in certain metal spheres, he laughed.
A victory that would echo around the game-playing galaxy, and it depends on where a child placed... His voice trailed off. He looked at the tiny drone again, frowning. Sorry, getting a bit melodramatic. He shrugged, leaned on the stone edge.
It would be pleasant to win, but it's unlikely, I'm afraid. Somebody else will do it, sometime.
But it might as well be you,
Morin Skell hissed, floating still closer. Gergay had to draw away to focus on the device.
Well, why leave it to chance, Jernau Gergay?
Morin Skell said, pulling back a little.
Why abandon it to mere stupid luck?
What are you talking about? Gergay said slowly, eyes narrowing. The drug trance was dissipating, the spell breaking. He felt keen, keyed up, nervous and excited at once.
I can tell you which beads are in which globes, Morin Skell said.
Gergay laughed gently. Nonsense. The drone floated closer.
I can. They didn't tear everything out of me when they turned me away from SC. I have more senses than cretins like Amalk Ney have even heard of.
It closed in.
Let me use them. Let me tell you what is where in your bead game. Let me help you to the full web.
Gergay stood back from the balustrade, shaking his head.
You can't. The other drones are weak simpletons, Gergay,
Morin Skell insisted.
I have the measure of them, believe me. Trust me. Another SC machine, definitely not. A contact drone, probably not. But this gang of obsoletes... I could find out where every bead that girl has placed is. Every single one.
You wouldn't need them all, Gergay said, looking troubled, waving his hand.
Well then, better yet. Let me do it, just to prove to you, to myself.
You're talking about cheating, Morin Skell, Gergay said, looking round the plaza. There was nobody nearby. The paper lanterns and the stone ribs they hung from were invisible from where he stood.
You're going to win? What difference does it make?
It's still cheating.
You said yourself it's all luck.
You've won, not definitely.
Almost certainly. 1,000 to 1 you don't.
Probably longer odds than that, Gergay conceded.
So the game is over. The girl can't lose any more than she has already. Let her be part of a game that will go down in history. Give her that.
It, Gergay said, slapping his hand on the stonework, is, another slap, still slap, cheating.
Keep your voice down, Morin Skell murmured.
It backed away a little. It spoke so low he had to lean out over the drop to hear it.
It's luck. All is luck when skill's played out. It was luck left me with a face that didn't fit in contact.
It's luck that made you a great game player. It's luck that put you here tonight. Neither of us were fully planned, Jernhagrige. Your genes determined you, and your mother's gene-affixing made certain you would not be a cripple or mentally subnormal. The rest is chance. I was brought into being with the freedom to be myself. If what that general plan and that particular luck produced is something a majority, mark you, not all, of one SC admissions board decides is not what they just happen to want, is it my fault? Is it?
No, Gurgi sighed, looking down.
Oh, it's all so wonderful in the culture, isn't it, Gurgi? Nobody starves and nobody dies of disease or natural disasters, and nobody and nothing's exploited. But there's still luck and heartache and joy. There's still chance and advantage and disadvantage.
The drone hung above the drop in the waking plane. Gurgi watched the orbital dawn come up, swinging from the edge of the world.
Take hold of your luck, Gurgi. Accept what I'm offering you. Just this once. Let's both make our own chances. You already know you're one of the best in the culture. I'm not trying to flatter you, you know that. But this win would seal that fame forever.
If it's possible, Gurgi said, then went silent, his jaw clenched. The drone sensed him trying to control himself the way he had done on the steps up to Haflis's house 7 hours ago.
If it isn't, at least have the courage to know, Morinskell said, voice pitched at an extremity of pleading.
The man raised his eyes to the clear blue pinks of dawn. The ruffled, misty plain looked like a vast and tousled bed. You're crazy, drone. You could never do it.
I know what I can do, Jernhagrge, the drone said.
It pulled away again, sat in the air regarding him. He thought of that morning, sitting on the train, the rush of that delicious fear. Like an omen now. Luck. Simple chance. He knew the drone was right. He knew it was wrong, but he knew it was right, too. It all depended on him. He leaned against the balustrade. Something in his pocket dug into his chest. He felt in, pulled out the hidden peace wafer he'd taken as a memento after the disastrous possession game. He turned the wafer over in his hands a few times. He looked at the drone, and suddenly felt very old and very childlike at the same time.
If, he said slowly, anything goes wrong, if you're found out, I'm dead.
I'll kill myself. Brain death, complete and utter, no remains.
Nothing is gonna go wrong. For me, it is the simplest thing in the world to find out what's inside those shells.
What if you're discovered, though? What if there is an SC drone around here somewhere, or the hub is watching? The drone said nothing for a moment.
They'd have noticed by now. It is already done.
Gurgi opened his mouth to speak, but the drone quickly floated closer, calmly continuing,
For my own sake, Gurgi, for my own peace of mind. I wanted to know, too. I came back long ago. I've been watching for the past 5 hours, quite fascinated. I couldn't resist finding out if it was possible. To be honest, I still don't know. The game is beyond me, just overcomplicated for the way my poor target-tracking mind is configured. But I had to try to find out. I had to. So you see, the risk is run, Gurgi. The deed is done. I can tell you what you need to know, and I ask nothing in return. That's up to you. Maybe you can do something for me someday, but no obligation. Believe me. Please believe me. No obligation at all. I'm doing this because I want to see you, somebody, anybody, do it.
Gurgi looked at the drone. His mouth was dry. He could hear somebody shouting at the distance. The terminal button on his jacket shoulder beeped. He drew breath to speak to it, but then heard his own voice say, Yes?
Ready to resume, Janel?
Chamlis said from the button, and he heard his own voice say, I'm on my way. He stared at the drone as the terminal beeped off. Morinskell floated closer.
As I said, Jerno Gurgi, I can fool these adding machines no problem at all. Quickly now. Do you want to know or not? The full web, yes or no?
Gergi glanced round in the direction of Haflis's apartments. He turned back, leaned out over the drop toward the drone. All right, he said, whispering. Just the 5 prime points and the 4 verticals nearest topside center. No more. Morin Skell told him. It was almost enough. The girl struggled brilliantly to the very end and deprived him on the final move. The full web fell apart, and he won by 31 points, too short of the culture's existing record. One of Estre Haflis's house drones was dimly confused to discover, while cleaning up under the great stone table much later that morning, a crushed and shattered ceramic wafer with warped and twisted number dial set into its crazed and distorted surface. It wasn't part of the house possession set. The machine's non-sentient, mechanistic, entirely predictable brain thought about it for a while, then finally decided to junk the mysterious remnant along with the rest of the debris. When he woke up that afternoon, it was with the memory of defeat. It was some time before he recalled that he had in fact won the stricken match. Victory had never been so bitter. He breakfasted alone on the terrace, watching a fleet of sailboats cut down the narrow fjord, bright sails in a fresh breeze. His right hand hurt a little as he held his bowl and cup. He'd come close to drawing blood when he'd crushed the possession wafer at the end of the stricken match. He dressed in a long coat, trews and short kilt, and went on a long walk down to the shore of the fjord and then along it toward the seacoast and the windswept dunes where Hassis lay, the house he'd been born in, where a few of his extended family still lived. He tramped along the coast path toward the house, through the blasted, twisted shapes of wind-misshapen trees. The grass made sighing noises around him, and seabirds cried. The breeze was cold and freshening under ragged clouds. Out to sea, beyond Hassi's village, where the weather was coming from, he could see tall veils of rain under a dark front of storm clouds. He drew his coat tighter about him and hurried toward the distant silhouette of the sprawling, ramshackle house, thinking he should have taken an underground car. The wind whipped up sand from the distant beach and threw it inland. He blinked, eyes watering.
Gergay.
The voice was quite loud, louder than the sound of sighing grass and wind-troubled tree branches. He shielded his eyes, looked to one side.
Gergay,
the voice said again. He peered into the shade of a stunted, slanting tree. Morin Skell. Is that you?
The same, the small drone said, floating forward over the path.
Gergi looked out to sea. He started down the path to the house again, but the drone did not follow him. Well, he told it, looking back from a few paces away, I must keep going. I'll get wet if I...
No, Morin Skell said. Don't go. I have to talk to you. This is important.
Then tell me as I walk, he said, suddenly annoyed. He strode away. The drone flashed round in front of him, at face level, so that he had to stop or he'd have bumped into it.
It's about the game, Stricken, last night and this morning.
I believe I already said thank you, he told the machine. He looked beyond it. The leading edge of the squall was hitting the far end of the village harbour beyond Hassis. The dark clouds were almost above him, casting a great shadow.
And I believe I said you might be able to help me one day.
Oh? Gergi said, with an expression more sneer than smile. And what am I supposed to be able to do for you?
Help me,
Morin Skell said quietly, voice almost lost in the noise of the wind.
Help me to get back into contact.
Don't be absurd, Gergi said, and put out one hand to swipe the machine out of his path. He forced his way past it. The next thing he knew, he'd been shoved down into the grass at the path side, as though shoulder-charged by someone invisible. He stared up in amazement at the tiny machine floating above him, while his hands felt the damp ground under him and the grass hissed on each side.
You little...
he said, trying to stand up. He was shoved back down again and sat there incredulous, simply unbelieving. No machine had ever used force on him. It was unheard of. He tried to rise again, a shout of anger and frustration forming in his throat. He went limp. The shout died in his mouth. He felt himself flop back into the grass. He lay there,
looking up into the dark clouds overhead. He could move his eyes. Nothing else. He remembered the missile chute and the immobility the suit had imposed on him when it had been hit once too often. This was worse. This was paralysis. He could do nothing. He worried about his breathing stopping, his heart stopping, his tongue blocking his throat, his bowels relaxing. Mohrin Skell floated into his field of view.
"Listen to me, Jernau Gyrgi."
Some cold drops of rain started to patter into the grass and onto his face.
"Listen to me. You shall help me. I have our entire conversation, your every word and gesture from this morning, recorded. If you don't help me, I'll release that recording. Everyone will know you cheated in the game against Alt's Hap."
The machine paused.
"Do you understand, Jernau Gyrgi? Have I made myself clear? Do you realize what I am saying? There is a name, an old name for what I am doing, in case you haven't already guessed. It is called blackmail."
The machine was mad. Anybody could make up anything they wanted. Sound, moving pictures, smell, touch. There were machines that did just that. You could order them from a store and effectively paint whatever pictures, still or moving, you wanted. And with sufficient time and patience, you could make it look as realistic as the real thing, recorded with an ordinary camera. You could simply make up any film sequence you wanted. Some people used such machines just for fun or revenge, making up stories where appalling or just funny things happened to their enemies or their friends. Where nothing could be authenticated, blackmail became both pointless and impossible. In a society like the culture, where next to nothing was forbidden, and both money and individual power had virtually ceased to exist, it was doubly irrelevant. The machine really must be mad. Gyrgi wondered if it intended to kill him. He turned the idea over in his mind, trying to believe it could happen.
"I know what's going through your mind, Gyrgi," the drone went on. "You're thinking that I can't prove it. I could have made it up. Nobody will believe me. Well, wrong. I had a real-time link with a friend of mine, an SC mind sympathetic to my cause, who's always known I would have made a perfectly good operative and has worked on my appeal. What passed between us this morning is recorded in perfect detail in a mind of unimpeachable moral credentials and a level of perceived fidelity unapproachable with the sort of facilities generally available. What I have on you could not have been falsified, Gyrgi. If you don't believe me, ask your friend Amalknay. It'll confirm all I say. It may be stupid and ignorant, too, but it ought to know where to find out the truth."
Rain struck Gyrgi's helpless, relaxed face. His jaw was slack and his mouth open, and he wondered if perhaps he would drown eventually, drowned by the falling rain. The drone's small body splashed and dripped above him as the drops grew larger and fell harder.
"You're wondering what I want from you," the drone said.
He tried to move his eyes to say no, just to annoy it, but it didn't seem to notice.
"Help," it said. "I need your help. I need you to speak for me. I need you to go to contact and add your voice to those demanding my return to active duty."
The machine darted down toward his face. He felt his coat collar pulled. His head and upper torso were lifted with a jerk from the damp ground until he stared helplessly at the grey-blue casing of the small machine. Pocket size, he thought, wishing he could blink and glad of the rain because he could not. Pocket size. It would fit into one of the big pockets in this coat. He wanted to laugh.
"Don't you understand what they've done to me, man?" the machine said, shaking him. "I've been castrated, spayed, paralyzed. How you feel now? Helpless. Knowing the limbs are there, but unable to make them work. Like that, but knowing that they aren't there. Can you understand that? Can you? Did you know that in our history people used to lose whole limbs forever? Do you remember your social history, little Jernau Gyrgi, eh?"
It shook him. He felt and heard his teeth rattle.
"Do you remember seeing cripples from before arms and legs just grew back? Back then, humans lost limbs, blown off or cut off or amputated, but still thought they had them, still thought they could feel them. Ghost limbs, they called them. Those unreal arms and legs could itch, and they could ache, but they could not be used. Can you imagine? Can you imagine that,
culture man, with your genofixed regrowth and your over-designed heart and your ducted glands and clot-filtered brain and flawless teeth and perfect immune system, can you?"
It let him fall back to the ground. His jaw jerked, and he felt his teeth nip the end of his tongue. A salt taste filled his mouth. Now he really would drown, he thought, in his own blood. He waited for real fear. The rain filled his eyes, but he could not cry.
"Well, imagine that. Times eight. Times more. Imagine what I feel, all set up to be the good soldier fighting for all that we hold dear, to seek out and smite the barbarians around us. Gone, Jirna Gergay. Raised. Gone. My sensory systems, my weapons, my very memory capacity, all reduced, laid waste, crippled. I peek into shells in a stricken game. I push you down with an eight-strength field and hold you there with an excuse for an electromagnetic effector. But this is nothing, Jirna Gergay. Nothing. An echo. A shadow. Nothing."
It floated higher, away from him. It gave him back the use of his body. He struggled off the damp ground and felt his tongue with one hand. The blood had stopped flowing, closed off. He sat up, a little groggy, feeling the back of his head where it had hit the ground. It was not sore. He looked at the small, dripping body of the machine floating over the path.
"I have nothing to lose, Gergay," it said. "Help me, or I'll destroy your reputation. Don't think I wouldn't. Whether it would mean almost nothing to you, which I doubt, I'd do it just for the fun of causing you even the smallest amount of embarrassment. And if it means everything, and you really would kill yourself, which I also very much doubt, then I would still. I've never killed a human before. It's possible I might have been given the chance, somewhere, sometime, if I'd been allowed to join SC. But I'd settle for causing a suicide."
He held up one hand to it. His coat felt heavy. The trews were soaked.
"I believe you," he said. "All right. But what can I do?" "I've told you," the drone said, over the noise of the wind howling in the trees and the rain beating against the swaying stalks of grass. "Speak for me. You have more influence than you realize. Use it." "But I don't. I've seen your mail, Gergay," the drone said tiredly. "Don't you know what a guest invitation from a GSV means? It's the closest contact ever comes to offering a post directly. Didn't anybody ever teach you anything besides games? Contact wants you. Officially, contact never headhunts. You have to apply. Then, once you're in it, it's the other way around. To join SC, you have to wait to be invited. But they want you, all right. Gods, man, can't you take a hint?"
"Even if you're right, what am I supposed to do? Just go to contact and say, 'Take this drone back?' That'd be stupid. I wouldn't even know how to start going about it." He didn't want to say anything about the visit from the contact drone the other evening. He didn't have to.
"Haven't they already been in touch with you?"
Morin Skell asked.
"The night before last?"
Gergay got shakily to his feet. He brushed some sandy earth from his coat. The rain gusted on the wind. The village on the coast and the sprawling house of his childhood were almost invisible under the dark sheets of driving rain.
"Yes, I've been watching you, Jirna Gergay," Morin Skell said. "I know Contact are interested in you. I have no idea just what it is Contact might want from you, but I suggest that you find out. Even if you don't want to play, you'd better make a damn good plea on my behalf. I'll be watching, so I'll know whether you do or not. I'll prove it to you. Watch."
A screen unfolded from the front of the drone's body like a strange flat flower, expanding to a square a quarter a meter or so to a side. It lit up in the rainy gloom to show Morin Skell itself suddenly glowing a blinding flashing white above the stone table at Haflis's house. The scene was shot from above, probably near one of the stone ribs over the terrace. Gergay watched again as the line of coals glowed bright and the lanterns and flowers fell. He heard Jamlis say,
"Oh dear, do you think I said something to upset it?"
He saw himself smile as he sat down by the stricken game set. The scene faded. It was replaced by another dim scene viewed from above. A bed. His bed, in the principal chamber at Ikro. He recognized the small, ringed hands of Ren Maeglin, kneading his back from beneath. There was sound, too.
Ah, Ren, my baby, my child, my love, Jano.
You piece of shit, he told the drone.
The scene faded, and the sound cut off. The screen collapsed, sucked back inside the body of the drone.
Just so. And don't you forget it, Jerno Gergay, Morinskell said. Those bits were quite fakeable, but you and I know they were real, don't we? Like I said, I'm watching you.
He sucked on the blood in his mouth, spat. You can't do this. Nobody's allowed to behave like this. You won't get away with it?
Well, maybe not. But the thing is, if I don't get away with it, I don't care. I'm no worse off. I'm still going to try.
It paused, physically shook itself free of water, then produced a spherical field about itself, clearing the moisture from its casing, leaving it spotless and clean, and sheltering it from the rain.
Can't you understand what they've done to me, man? Better I had never been brought into being than forced to wander the culture forever, knowing what I've lost. They call it compassion to draw my talons and remove my eyes and cast me adrift in a paradise made for others. I call it torture. It's obscene, Gergay. It's barbaric. Diabolic. Recognize that old word? I see you do. Well, try to imagine how I might feel and what I might do. Think about it, Gergay. Think about what you can do for me and what I can do to you.
The machine drew away from him again, retreating through the pouring rain. The cold drops splashed on top of its invisible globe of fields, and little rivulets of water ran round the transparent surface of that sphere to dribble underneath, falling in a steady stream into the grass.
I'll be in touch. Goodbye, Gergay, Morinskell said.
The drone flicked away, tearing over the grass and into the sky in a grey cone of slipstream. Gergay lost sight of it within seconds. He stood for a while, brushing sand and bits of grass from his sodden clothes, then turned to walk back in the direction he'd come from, through the falling rain and the beating wind. He looked back once, to gaze again upon the house where he'd grown up, but the squall, billowing round the low summits of the rolling dunes, had all but obscured the rambling, chaotic structure.
But Gergay, what is the problem?
I can't tell you. He walked up to the rear wall of the main room of Chamliss's apartment, turned and paced back again, before going to stand by the window. He looked out over the square. People walked or sat at tables under the awnings and archways of the pale green stone galleries which lined the village's main square. Fountains played. Birds flew from tree to tree, and on the tiled roof of the square's central bandstand stage holoscreen housing, a jet-black zile, almost the size of a full-grown human, lay sprawled, one leg hanging over the edge of the tiles, its trunk, tail and ears all twitched as it dreamed. Its rings and bracelets and earrings glinted in the sunlight. Even as Gergay watched, the creature's thin trunk articulated lazily, stretching back over its head to scratch indolently at the back of its neck, near its terminal collar. Then the black proboscis fell back as though exhausted, to swing to and fro for a few seconds. Laughter drifted up through the warm air from some nearby tables. A red-coloured dirigible floated over distant hills like a vast blob of blood in the blue sky. He turned back into the room again. Something about the square, the whole village, disgusted and angered him. Yane was right. It was all too safe and twee and ordinary. They might as well be on a planet. He walked over to where Chamliss floated near the long fish tank. Chamliss's aura was tinged with grey frustration. The old drone gave an exasperated shudder and picked up a little container of fish food. The tank lid lifted, and Chamliss sprinkled some of the food grains onto the top of the water. The glittering mirrorfish moved silkily up to the surface, mouths working rhythmically.
Gergay, Chamliss said reasonably, how can I help you if you won't tell me what's wrong?
Just tell me. Is there any way you can find out more about what Contact wanted to talk about? Can I get in touch with them again, without everybody else knowing, or... He shook his head, put his hands to his head.
No, I suppose people will know, but it doesn't matter.
He stopped at the wall, stood looking at the warm sandstone blocks between the paintings. The apartments had been built in an old-fashioned style. The pointing between the sandstone blocks was dark, inlaid with little white pearls. He gazed at the richly beaded lines and tried to think, tried to know what it was he could ask and what there was he could do.
"I can get in touch with the two ships I know," Chambliss said. "The ones I contacted originally. I can ask them. They might know what contact was going to suggest."
Chambliss watched the silvery fish silently feeding.
"I'll do that now, if you like."
"Please, yes," he said, and turned away from the manufactured sandstone and the cultivated pearls. His shoes clacked across the patterned tiles of the room. The sunlit square again, the Tzile still sleeping. He could see its jaws moving, and wondered what alien words the creature was mouthing in its sleep.
"It'll be a few hours before I hear anything," Chambliss said.
The fish tank lid closed. The drone put the fish food container into a drawer in a tiny, delicate table near the tank.
"Both ships are fairly distant."
Chambliss tapped the side of the tank with a silvered field. The mirrorfish floated over to investigate.
"But why?" the drone said, looking at him. "What's changed? What sort of trouble are you? Can you be in? Gergay, please tell me. I want to help."
The machine floated closer to the tall human, who was standing staring down to the square, his hands clasped and unconsciously kneading each other. The old drone had never seen the man so distressed.
"Nothing," Gergay said hopelessly, shaking his head, not looking at the drone. "Nothing's changed. There's no trouble. I just need to know a few things."
He had gone straight back to Ikro the day before. He'd stood in the main room, where the house had lit the fire a couple of hours earlier after hearing the weather forecast, and he'd taken off the wet, dirty clothes and thrown them all onto the fire. He'd had a hot bath and a steam bath, sweating and panting and trying to feel clean. The plunge bath had been so cold there had been a thin covering of ice on it. He'd dived in, half expecting his heart to stop with the shock. He'd sat in the main room watching the logs burn. He'd tried to pull himself together, and once he'd felt capable of thinking clearly, he'd raised Chark Hub.
"Gergay, Makelstrabagian at your service. How's Trix? Not another visitation from contact, surely?"
"No. But I have a feeling they left something behind when they were here. Something to watch me."
"What? You mean a bug or a microsystem or something?"
"Yes," he said, sitting back in the broad couch.
He wore a simple robe. His skin felt scrubbed and shiny clean after his bathe. Somehow, the friendly, understanding voice of Hub made him feel better. It would be all right. He'd work something out. He was probably frightened over nothing. Morin Skell was just a demented, insane machine with delusions of power and grandeur. It wouldn't be able to prove anything, and nobody would believe it if it simply made unsubstantiated claims.
"What makes you think you're being bugged?"
"I can't tell you," Gergay said. "Sorry, but I've seen some evidence. Can you send something? Drones or whatever to Ikro to sweep the place. Would you be able to find something if they did leave anything?"
"If it's ordinary tech stuff, yes. But it depends on the soft level. A warship can passive bug using its electromagnetic effector. They can watch you under 100 clicks of rock cover from the next stellar system, and tell you what your last meal was. Hyperspace tech, there are defenses against it, but no way of detecting it's going on."
"Nothing that complicated. Just a bug or a camera or something."
"Should be possible. We'll displace a drone team to you in a minute or so. Want us to harden this comm channel? Can't make it totally eavesdrop-proof, but we can make it difficult."
"Please."
"No problem. Detach the terminal speaker pip and shove it in your ear. We'll soundfield the outside."
Gergay did just that. He felt better already. The hub seemed to know what it was doing.
"Thanks, hub," he said. "I appreciate all this."
"Hey, no thanks required, Gergay. That's what we're here for. Besides, this is fun."
Gergay smiled. There was a distant thump somewhere above the house as the hub's drone team arrived. The drones swept the house for sensory equipment and secured the buildings and grounds. They polarized the windows and drew the drapes. They put some sort of special mat under the couch he sat on. They even installed a kind of filter or valve inside the chimney of the fire. Gergay felt grateful and cosseted, and both important and foolish all at once. He set to work. He used his terminal to probe the hub's information banks. They contained, as a matter of course, almost every even moderately important or significant or useful piece of information the culture had ever accumulated. A near infinite ocean of fact and sensation and theory and artwork which the culture's information net was adding to at a torrential rate every second of the day. You could find out most things if you knew the right questions to ask. Even if you didn't, you could still find out a lot. The culture had theoretical total freedom of information. The catch was that consciousness was private, and information held in a mind, as opposed to an unconscious system like the hub's memory banks, was regarded as part of the mind's being, and so as sacrosanct as the contents of a human brain. A mind could hold any set of facts and opinions it wanted without having to tell anybody what it knew or thought or why. And so, while Hub protected his privacy, Gergay found out, without having to ask Chamlis, that what Morin Skell had said might be true. There were indeed levels of event recording which could not be easily faked, and which drones of above average specification were potentially capable of using. Such recordings, especially if they had been witnessed by a mind in a real time link, would be accepted as genuine. His mood of renewed optimism started to sink away from him again. Also, there was an SC mind, that of the Limited Offensive Unit Gunboat Diplomat, which had supported Morin Skell's appeal against the decision which had removed the drone from special circumstances. The feeling of dazed sickness started to fill him again. He wasn't able to find out when Morin Skell and the LOU had last been in touch. That, again, counted as private information. Privacy. That brought a bitter laugh to his mouth, thinking of the privacy he'd had over the last few days and nights. But he did discover that a drone like Morin Skell, even in civilianized form, was capable of sustaining a one-way real-time link with such a ship over millennia distances, so long as the ship was watching out for the signal and knew where to look. He could not find out there and then where the gunboat diplomat was in the galaxy. SC ships routinely kept their location secret, but put in a request that the ship release its position to him. From what he could tell from the information he discovered, Morin Skell's claim that the mind had recorded their conversation would not hold up if the ship was more than about 20 millennia away. If it turned out, say, that the craft was on the other side of the galaxy, then the drone had definitely lied, and he would be safe. He hoped the vessel was on the other side of the galaxy. He hoped it was 100,000 light-years away or more, or it had gone crazy and run into a black hole or decided to head for another galaxy, or stumbled across a hostile alien ship powerful enough to blow it out of the skies. Anything, so long as it wasn't nearby and able to make that real-time link. Otherwise, everything Morin Skell had said checked out. It could be done. He could be blackmailed. He sat in the couch while the fire burned down and the hub drones floated through the house, humming and clicking to themselves, and he stared into the greying ashes, wishing that it was all unreal. Wishing it hadn't happened, cursing himself for letting the little drone talk him into cheating. Why? He asked himself. Why did I do it? How could I have been so stupid? It had seemed a glamorous, enticingly dangerous thing at the time. A little crazy, but then was he not different from other people? Was he not the great game player, and so allowed his eccentricities, granted the freedom to make his own rules? He hadn't wanted self-glorification, not really, and he had already won the game. He just wanted somebody in the culture to have completed a full web, hadn't he? It wasn't like him to cheat. He had never done it before. He would never do it again. How could Morin Skell do this to him? Why had he done it? Why couldn't it just not have happened? Why didn't they have time travel? Why couldn't he go back and stop it happening? Ships that could circumnavigate the galaxy in a few years and count every cell in your body from light-years off, but he wasn't able to go back one miserable day and alter one tiny, stupid, idiotic, shameful decision. He clenched his fists, trying to break the terminal he held in his right hand. But it wouldn't break. His hand hurt again. He tried to think calmly. What if the worst did happen? The culture was generally rather disdainful of individual fame and therefore equally uninterested in scandal. There was, anyway, little that was scandalous. But Gergay had no doubt that if Morin Skell did release the recordings it claimed to have made, They would be propagated. People would know. There were plenty of news and current affairs, indices and networks, and the multiplicity of communications which linked every culture habitat, be it ship, rock, orbital or planet. Somebody somewhere would be only too pleased to broadcast Morinskell's recordings. Gergay knew of a couple of recently established games indices whose editors, writers and correspondents regarded him and most of the other well-known players and authorities as some sort of constricting, overprivileged hierarchy. They thought too much attention was paid to too few players and sought to discredit what they called the old guard, which included him, much to his amusement. They would love what Morinskell had on him. He could deny it all once it was out, and some people would doubtless believe him, despite the hardness of the evidence. But the other top players, and the responsible, well-established and authoritative indices, would know the truth of it. And that was what he would not be able to bear. He would still be able to play, and he would still be allowed to publish, to register his papers as open for dissemination, and probably many of them would be taken up. Not quite so often as before, perhaps. But he would not be frozen out completely. It would be worse than that. He would be treated with compassion, understanding, tolerance, but he would never be forgiven. Could he come to terms with that, ever? Could he weather the storm of abuse and knowing looks, the gloating sympathy of his rivals? Would it all die down enough eventually? Would a few years pass and it be sufficiently forgotten? He thought not. Not for him. It would always be there. He could not face down Morinskell with that "publish and be damned." The drone had been right. It would destroy his reputation. Destroy him. He watched the logs in the wide grate glow duller red, and then go soft and grey. He told Hub he was finished. It quietly returned the house to normal, and left him alone with his thoughts. He woke the next morning, and it was still the same universe. It had not been a nightmare, and time had not gone backward. It had all still happened. He took the underground to Chelek, the village where Chamlis Amaltne lived, by itself, in an old-fashioned and odd approximation of human domesticity, surrounded by wall paintings, antique furniture, inlaid walls, fish tanks and insect vivaria.
"I'll find out all I can, Gergay," Chamlis sighed, floating beside him, looking out to the square. "But I can't guarantee that I can do it without whoever was behind your last visit from contact finding out about it. They may think you're interested."
"Maybe I am," Gergay said. "Maybe I do want to talk to them again, I don't know."
"Well, I've sent the message to my friends, but..."
He had a sudden paranoid idea. He turned to Chamlis urgently. "These friends of yours are ships?"
"Yes," Chamlis said. "Both of them."
"What are they called?"
"The Of Course I Still Love You, and the Just Read the Instructions."
"They're not warships?"
"With names like that? They're GCUs. What else?"
"Good," Gergay said, relaxing a little, looking out to the square again. "Good. That's all right." He took a deep breath.
"Gergay, can't you please tell me what's wrong?"
Chamlis's voice was soft. Even sad.
"You know it'll go no further. Let me help. It hurts me to see you like this. If there's anything I can..."
"Nothing," Gergay said, looking at the machine again. He shook his head. "There's nothing. Nothing else you can do. I'll let you know if there is." He started across the room. Chamlis watched him. "I have to go now. I'll see you again, Chamlis." He went down to the underground. He sat in the car, staring at the floor. On about the fourth request, he realized the car was talking to him, asking where he wanted to go. He told it. He was staring at one of the wall screens, watching the steady stars, when the terminal beeped.
"Gergay? Makis Trabe. Yet again. One more time. Once more."
"What?" he snapped, annoyed at the mind's glib chumminess.
"That ship just replied with the information you asked for."
He frowned. "What ship? What information?"
"The gunboat Diplomat. Our game player. Its location."
His heart pounded and his throat seemed to close up.
"Yes,"
he said, struggling to get the word out.
"And?" "Well, it didn't reply direct.
It sent via its home GSV, Youthful Indiscretion, and got it to confirm its location.
Yes, well, where is it?
In the Altavian North Cluster. Sent coordinates, though they're only accurate to...
Never mind the coordinates! Gerge shouted. Where is that cluster? How far away is it from here?
Hey, calm down. It's about 2.5 millennia away. He sat back, closing his eyes. The car started to slow down. 2,500 light-years. It was, as the urbanely well-travelled people on a GSV would say, a long walk. But close enough, by quite a long way, for a warship to minutely target an effector, throw a sensing field a light second in diameter across the sky, and pick up the weak but indisputable flicker of coherent HS light coming from a machine small enough to fit into a pocket. He tried to tell himself it was still no proof that Morhinskell might still have been lying. But even as he thought that, he saw something ominous in the fact the warship had not replied direct. It had used its GSV, an even more reliable source of information, to confirm its whereabouts.
"Want the rest of the LOU's message?" Hub said. "Or are you going to bite my head off again?"
Gerge was puzzled.
"What rest of message?" he said.
The underground car swung round, slowed further. He could see ICRO's transit gallery hanging under the plate surface like an upside-down building.
"Mysteriouser and mysteriouser," Hub said.